Shrink Wrap Radio number 282, A Hollywood Perspective on Story, with producer Lindsay Doran.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. All in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Lindsay Doran, has worked in the movie business for more than 30 years as a studio executive and as a producer. Among her credits are such hits as Ghost, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Field of Dreams, two of the James Bond films, and the Nanny McPhee films. Most recently, she is the winner of numerous awards, including the Golden Globe Best Picture Award and the British Academy Award for Best Film, both for Sense and Sensibility. Please refer to the show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com for a more detailed description of her background. Now, here's the interview. Lindsay Doran, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm so thrilled to have you here. You and I met briefly in a small group exercise at the Second World Congress on Positive Psychology, and I hope to have a short interview with you then and there. That didn't happen. We missed each other, and I'm really glad that it didn't happen, because now I get to do a longer one, and I know you've got a lot of good stuff, so I'm really happy to have this longer period with you.
Good.
A question that I didn't get a chance to ask you there is how you, a Hollywood film executive, came to be at a conference on positive psychology. How did that happen?
Well, let's see. I'm a producer, not an executive. I've been an executive a lot in my career, but at the moment I'm a producer. It's a strange story. 20 years ago or so, I read Dr. Martin Seligman's book, Learned Optimism.
Yeah.
Recommended by a friend of mine, and it was a life-changing event. I've got so much out of that book, both personally and professionally. And I did something I'd never done before and have never done since, which is I called up the author. I literally called him up. I remember somewhere in Catcher in the Rye, Holden Caulfield talks about how he wishes he could call up Ring Lardner, and I thought, I'm going to just call this guy up. So I called him up. He took my call, and I asked him some questions about the book, which he answered very promptly and intelligently, and so we started kind of getting to know each other by phone. We talked about the notion of making a TV series out of the idea of based on therapy. Each episode would be a therapy session, and you know, eventually the HBO series In Treatment was very much like what we were talking about.
Yes.
Then that never came to pass. But
you were ahead of your time.
Yeah, we were so ahead of our time.
Yeah.
So we talked about those things, and then we were in touch over the 20 years. But I'd never met him, and I didn't follow what he was doing at all. I had no idea what a rock star he was in the world of psychology. I just thought he was some guy who wrote a book. I really didn't know anything about him at all. I had no idea he'd been the president of the American Psychological Association, and I didn't know anything that he was starting this whole movement about positive psychology. I didn't know anything. And then last year, I got an email from him inviting me to a conference that was being held in a country house in England on the subject of flourishing, which is the subject of his latest book that came out just quite recently. And I'd never met him. I'd never met anybody else in the conference. And it turned out to be, you know, doctors and psychologists and sociologists and you know, political scientists and headmasters and people who were already very much into this field of positive psychology, and everybody gave a presentation from their field about how all that was working out in terms of the work that they were doing. And I showed a film I produced a few years ago called Stranger Than Fiction, and didn't really realize until I was there how closely it mirrored everything that everybody was talking about, because Dr. Seligman, you know, in his book, talks about the sort of five elements of well-being, which are, let me see if I can get them right, positive emotions and engagement and positive relationships and accomplishments and meaning. And I thought all of those were things that Stranger Than Fiction covered. I don't know if you've seen the film, but
you
Will
know,
Ferrell
I missed
plays.
The film. Are you saying it was shown at the conference?
Yeah, it was shown at that, not at the conference that you and I went to together, but at a conference that Marty invited me to that took place a year ago in England.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, Will Ferrell plays a man who finds out that he's a character in a novel, and then he finds out that he's going to die very imminently and has to go search for the author and see if he can get her to change the end of her book.
I think I did see that film, actually.
Oh, okay.
I saw it in general release.
Yeah, it was 2006, I think. So anyway, the film cuts back and forth between Will Ferrell desperately trying to find the author and Emma Thompson, who plays the author, desperately trying to figure out a way to kill off her main character. And at a certain point, he realizes he's never going to find her. It's hopeless, and that the things that he's been trying to do to get her to change the ending on his own aren't working. And he realizes he has to just face his death and live his life. And the things that he does in that part of the film are exactly what Marty Seligman was talking about in his book. He does things that he enjoys. He goes to see a Monty Python movie in the middle of the day. He takes walks instead of taking the bus. He has always loved a girl, and he decides that he's going to go try to actually have a love affair with her. He's always wanted to learn to play the guitar, and so he goes and learns how to play the guitar. He becomes friends with somebody at work who was just a guy at work. And ultimately, he finds a way to give his life meaning, which it never really had before. So everything that had been covered, you know, in what everybody else was talking about was right there in that film. And so the whole experience, it was like 5 days last September, and it was a very, very meaningful experience for me. And so I stayed in touch with a lot of the people that I met at that conference. And earlier this year, I was invited to speak at the master's program in positive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, yes.
I came back in April. And I showed a different film that I produced, Sense and Sensibility, as an example of something that had been talked about at the conference, which is why don't critics give good reviews to happy movies? And that is a happy movie, and it got really good reviews and won a lot of awards. So it was an example of how you actually can pull that off, although that was not my intention at the time.
And I also showed
my favorite film from my childhood, which was Pollyanna, which is dead on the subject of happiness and has received all of the criticism that, you know, stories like that, you know, Pollyanna has become a cliche for mindless happiness. Well, in fact, if you read the book or see the movie, you realize it's not that at all.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, all of this has not only had tremendous meaning for me personally, but tremendous meaning for me professionally. Every single aspect of this feeds back into the process of creating a film script and a film. So anyway, after my experience at the master's class, I was invited to speak at the World Congress where you and I met. So that's how I showed up there. And it was very daunting. You know, I realized very quickly I was speaking in front of people who were not from my field at all.
Yes, yes.
And that I couldn't assume anything about what they knew or what they brought to the experience. But I'm really glad I did it. As scary as it was a great experience.
Oh, yes. And when we met in that small group, I didn't even know that you were going to be a presenter. And then later I happened to go to your presentation, and I think it was the title that drew me. Well, your name had been mentioned actually on the podium by Martin Seligman, so I kind of had you tagged as somebody that I was definitely interested in speaking to and knowing more about. And then I went to your presentation, and that was so well received. You were just great. You were funny and, lively. And I seem to recall you might have even gotten a standing ovation.
Well, I got a response that I have to say was much bigger than I had expected. I was so glad there were a lot of people there, for one thing. And Marty did mention me in his big keynote speech, because he's a big believer that the arts are going to be an important part of carrying the message of positive psychology. That to him is as important as education and all the other fields that he's trying to, you know, work in.
I've been surprised by the scope of his thinking. He really is thinking big.
It's really something, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is quite remarkable. And I also didn't realize until just before I started speaking what a resistance there is to that idea. That the idea, you know, from in my background, everybody's taking film courses and art courses, and when they hear they have to take a science course, it's like, oh God, you know, isn't there some way I can get to that? And it was became very clear, you know, and when James Pawelski introduced our panel, that we were speaking to people who were exactly the opposite. They're taking all the science courses, all the research courses, and when they hear they have to take an arts course, like, oh, God, I don't like that. So it was a very, very different kind of crowd. But I think there were a couple of things that happened. For one thing, I've never used PowerPoint. And so when they asked me if I wanted something like that, I said, no, I don't. And I actually think that makes a huge difference.
I think it
you know,
does
I'd too. I'd like to think that it was all the brilliant things that I said that got that reaction, but I honestly think I was the only speaker that was looking everybody in the eye and was able to actually play off the responses that I was getting, or I would spot somebody and say, oh, well, you know, this will be particularly interesting to you, or, you know, I could see people. Some of them were people that I had met and knew, and some of them were brand new people, but I could kind of, you know, you play the audience the way you play an instrument, and I was looking at them, and they were looking at me. And it was, you know, because that's the other part of PowerPoint is not only are you not looking at them, you're looking down at a screen. They're not looking at you. They're looking up at a screen.
Yeah.
So here's, you have a conference which is all about human interaction and the importance of human relationships and how crucial it is that people have these relationships that mean something. And yet, all of the presentations that I went to, almost without exception, were situations in which nobody was looking until the questions
started. That's such a good point that you're making.
Yeah, I sent a thing to everybody afterwards and said, you know, I really do think people have to draw a lesson from this. I'm terribly flattered I got such a great reaction, but I honestly think part of it was that I was looking at them and they were looking at me, and it was an intimate experience, even though there were 200 people in the room.
Yeah, well, PowerPoint has kind of taken over in education. It's used more and more and more, so I think students are getting a lot less of that eye contact. But that's really going to carry us down another road than I wanted to go here. So, but I'm really glad to learn that. I'm interested in your work from a number of perspectives. I'm a big movie buff. You know, I've seen the movies that you mentioned, fortunately. I'm obviously interested as a psychologist, and that's the primary focus of this show. And I'm also been very interested in the positive psychology movement and kind of tracking it, because I came out of a humanistic psychology background, which kind of preceded this, though Martin doesn't give it, he doesn't spend any time on that, but there really is a movement that preceded this. But also, for a long time, I've been involved in market research and have been a focus group moderator. Yeah, so I know you've been on one side of the mirror, and I've been on the other side of the mirror. I know Hollywood does extensive consumer research. So,
right, yeah.
So I'm just really have lots of reasons to be fascinated by you and your work. Now, in your presentation, you pointed out that Hollywood spends an enormous amount of money each year doing things like focus groups and I don't know what else to figure out what will make film goers happy.
What have
we found out?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It isn't that they're doing that kind of research. It's more the research that's done, and they'll do sort of trends in, you know, what's going on in society in general, and, you know, they'll tell you things like that, you know, the biggest problem that that teenagers feel today is that they feel invisible. You know, and that's an interesting piece of information to have if you're making, you know, a movie, you know, for teenagers. Or they'll, you know, they'll give you some sort of sense of, you know, the trend is towards this or the trend is towards that. But mostly what they're doing is finding out whether the movie you've just made is making an audience happy. That's where most of the money goes, is you make a movie and then you figure out who the movie would normally be aimed at. I mean, the movie like Sense and Sensibility, you know, they sort of knew it was more women than men, and it was the kinds of women who would have seen things like Howard's End and Remains of the Day. So you put together an audience that reflects the kind of people you think would show up on opening weekend, and you show them the movie, and then they fill out cards I spent a lot of time composing those cards, actually, because I think this kind of research is crucial. And, you know, a lot of it is very general about, you know, which was your favorite character, and would you recommend this to your friends, and do you think this is appropriate for all audiences or just, you know, people of a certain age, and what do you think of the ending, and, you know, if you have any very specific, you know, questions about certain characters.
Yeah, don't they also sometimes focus group alternate
Then they do a
endings?
Focus group. After that, they've selected 20 people out of the line that they think represent the audience in age and gender and things like that. And then those 20 people stay behind. So after everybody's finished filling out the cards, then you do the focus group. And I've actually led some of those focus groups myself when we've had screenings that were so private that we didn't even want, you know, a big research company involved, because then the studio has to be involved.
Yes.
We've had, you know, little groups of maybe 50 people, and we've saved out 20 people. And I've been watching focus groups for 30 years now or more. And I actually used to go to them when I was a teenager. And that was one of the things I loved to do on weekends, was to go to studio previews and fill out those cards and be in those focus groups. So I've been on all the ends of this. I've been on every single end of it. But I think running a focus group is a very interesting activity. And it's terrifying when it's your own film, and trying to behave completely neutral towards answers is scary. But I find sometimes that people who are hired to do it, who should be completely neutral, are not so neutral. You know, somebody will say, well, I really like the film. And the guy will say, oh, come on. And once I saw that kind of thing going on, I thought, all right, I can do this. You know, if he can get paid for it, I can do it for free.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's in the focus group where you really, I mean, I'm always saying to new directors, you know, who've never been through this before, the first question is going to be, how many of you like the film? You know, how many of you wrote down on the card that you scored the film excellent? And if 15 out of 20 hands don't go up, at least we're in trouble. And then the next question is always, you know, how many of you said that you would definitely recommend the film? And it's the same thing. If 15 out of 20 hands don't go up, we're in trouble. And then it's really about figuring out what went wrong and why are we not satisfying people and what did they expect. And you know, you can. It's fascinating to me, all of that work. So, but what's happened, of course, is that, you know, studios have been doing this kind of research since the silent days. If you look at Singing in the Rain, you can see that even in that, they're doing previews. And previews were a huge part of silent films. They would literally go out and reshoot the movie the next day after previews, and they always knew that that's what they were going to do. So these companies that do the research have a lot of information that they're not used to sharing about what's really going on and what makes audiences happy. And I was able to get one guy to kind of open up a little bit about the kinds of things that he's learned, and it was pretty interesting.
Well, you've done a bunch of research on your own. I got that impression from your presentation.
Well, really, the research that I've done, I mean, you know, being part of market research on the films that I've worked on, and, you know, as a studio executive, I would sometimes, you know, be in charge of 5 movies in a single year or more, and then as a producer also, I've worked on a lot of things. So I've been to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of focus groups and things like that. But this was the first time, in anticipation of my speech at the World Congress, this was the first time I actually went to people who do audience research for a living and say, what do you got? What do you know? And, you know, and sort of say, look, here are the 5 elements of well-being that are in this book, and does any of that relate to what you're learning from all these audiences that you're working with? And I was able to get a little bit of information out of them. You know, it's, they own it and they don't want to give it away for free, but I was able to get a little bit of information that I found really interesting.
So what's your sense of how well Seligman's PERMA articulates with happiness in film, with the film success?
I thought there were a few, I mean, the substance of my speech was that, you know, looking at the first one, positive emotions, that there are, you know, that's one of the things that Hollywood movies are for, and it's one of the reasons that they are the most successful movies in the world, you know, that in other countries, they are much more likely to make films that are downers, for lack of a better word, you know, that are very serious subjects and not necessarily happy endings, and the result is that they may make those movies in their countries, but people in their own countries are much more likely to go see a movie that comes out of Hollywood than they are to see a movie that comes out of their own country, most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time. So I think Hollywood is sort of synonymous with happy movies and movies that make you feel good and good. You know, it's like working with the positive psychology group is one of the few times where I haven't felt criticized for that, where that's actually a good thing, where they don't see anything bad about that. And one of the things I thought about as I thought about that particular thing was that there are movies, or there used to be, not so much anymore, but there used to be movies that I thought were pure positive emotions. I mean, the Fred Astaire movies, you know, and Singing in the Rain, and, you know, there are some of the musicals from the 30s, and sort of all the way through Hollywood, there have been comedies and musicals that have been meant to make you feel great all the way through. And probably, you know, the movies that I've worked on, I think of The Naked Gun, which I worked on in the 80s, as being something that's just fun start to finish. I think of Ferris Bueller's Day Off as, even though it has like a 5-minute scene that's a little bit scary and disturbing, when, you know, Ferris's friend Cameron seems to become catatonic out of fear of his father, that goes away very quickly, and then you go back right back to having a wonderful time. I'm not sure that we're doing that right this second in Hollywood, but I do think that we sort of specialize in happy endings and positive emotions in Hollywood. So that's positive emotions. Engagement, obviously the audience's engagement with the film is crucial. We count on that, and one of the things you find out in those focus groups and in those cars is whether or not people got bored, and where did they get bored, and why did they get bored. But what I thought was more interesting than that was, and something that I've been noticing for a very long time, which is that we love watching engagement. We are very engaged by watching characters who are engaged mm-hmm. in something. I mean, this weekend there's a movie opening called Moneyball, you know, about a real-life baseball team manager who figured out how to use statistics to completely put together a team that nobody else would ever have put together. And, you know, if his engagement in those statistics is really interesting to watch. If you look at a movie like Social Network, we're spending an awful lot of time watching characters watching screens. We're watching a screen on which there's a character watching a screen.
Yeah.
And their engagement in that activity is fascinating. We're fascinated by people who are engaged in crime, engaged in dancing, engaged in learning to sing, engaged in learning to ride, all kinds of different things. So I think engagement is a very crucial part of successful movies. And since I had just been making lists of movies that I thought were pure positive emotions, I thought, well, can I make a list of movies that are pure engagement? And I was just literally writing things down without giving them much thought. And the three movies I wrote down were Godfather 2, Silence of the Lambs, and No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked at that list later, I thought, well, that's interesting because, A, they're very grim.
Yes.
Every
yes.
single one of those is
yeah.
grim. And, B, every single one of them won the Academy Award for Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that means. I really don't. But I've talked to a lot of people about this now, and they all kind of agree that, you know, the Godfather movies, everybody knows, at least in the people that I spend my time with, you know, we all have this same experience, which you're doing something in the morning and you turn on the television and there is any scene from the Godfather and you stop what you're doing and the next thing you know it's 20 minutes later. You're still completely engaged.
Yeah.
But if you think about all three of those movies, what we're watching are people engaged in committing crimes and people engaged in trying to stop crime, mostly hopelessly engaged, you know, not successfully engaged. And that's it. You know, there's no positive emotions. There's no positive relationships. There's no positive accomplishments. And finding meaning in any of that is very difficult. You know, I maybe the filmmakers would disagree with me. I hope they would. But I don't see any particular meaning that comes out of any of those films. And they're very, very grim. And a lot of people find them very, very depressing. But you are watching engagement.
Okay.
When you're watching those films.
Yes.
Those were my thoughts about engagement, which
okay.
I thought were pretty interesting. And then I began looking at accomplishments and relationships, because the one little piece of advice or the one little piece of information I was able to get out of one of these research companies when I was listing off these five things was somebody said to me, well, you know, audiences aren't really that interested in accomplishments. And I went, really? Because I think of accomplishments as being the bread and butter of the movie business.
Yeah.
We're always making movies about winners, and that is, you know, what everybody thinks that we're doing. Where somebody sets out to save the world, or somebody sets out to be a successful singer, or somebody sets out to be, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
And then the movie shows them achieving that, right?
Yeah.
And he said, no, they're not really that interested in accomplishments. What they're interested in is the moment afterwards when that accomplishment is shared with somebody else. And that really set me thinking, because I thought, okay, well, maybe what that's saying then is that as human beings, there is a hierarchy to these things, this permits stuff that Marty Seligman is talking about, and that what we really value more than positive accomplishments are positive relationships. And when I had been making lists of movies to show, you know, that we make movies about positive accomplishments, the three that I had written down were Karate Kid, Dirty Dancing, and The King's Speech. I thought that kind of covered all the bases. You know, at the end of Dirty Dancing, Jennifer Grey does this leap that she was afraid to make earlier in the film, and at the end she leaps into Patrick Swayze's arms. And then at the end of The Karate Kid, you know, I was thinking about the new version when he does this impossible kick. I mean, he does that in both versions, but I had seen the new one most recently. But after he does the impossible kick, there's a beautiful moment where he reconciles with his opponent. There's a beautiful moment where he shares it with his mother, with his sensei, with a little girl that he's met. It's like the movie does not end with the kick. And I thought, you know, if we were really making movies about accomplishments, we'd just end with a kick. We'd end with the leap. And then I looked at The King's Speech and realized that the last thing you see at the end of The King's Speech is a card that says, Lionel and Bertie remained friends for the rest of their lives. That's the speech therapist in The King.
Yes.
And I know the producers of The King's Speech, and I called them up and I said, this is interesting. Did it always end that way? And they said, no, you know, it's funny. The relationship kind of took over the movie. And it wasn't until the movie was finished that we realized we couldn't just end with the speech. We had to acknowledge that relationship and make sure the audience knew that those people were going to go on being friends forever. It wasn't just that this one thing brought them together and then the king went back to being a king and he went back to being a commoner and they never talked anymore. They were friends. And that acknowledgement of that friendship was the right ending for that movie, which again won the Academy Award for Best Picture. So this was kind of news to me. You know, I had never really thought about it that way before. And, you know, when I was at Paramount in the 80s, they had made, you know, Top Gun. And Top Gun is a perfect example of, you know, this very arrogant guy, you know, portrayed by Tom Cruise, who wants more than anything to be the best dogfighter of fighter jets in the whole world, and there's a very specific trophy that you get, you know, if you're going to do that, and the real prize is that you get to come back and teach at Top Gun school. And at the end of the movie, he comes back to teach at Top Gun school, but the last scene of the movie is about his broken relationship with Kelly McGillis, and, you know, they have to make up in order to have the right end of the movie. So it becomes pretty clear that, you know, there are certainly people who will probably say, oh, yeah, well, that's the formula, but why is it the formula? Why is it when you make a movie as macho as Top Gun, you don't end with a jet? Mm-hmm. You end with a girl and a love song.
It's a good issue.
You know, why is the formula the formula? And how often, like the producers of The King's Speech, we don't know that that's the right end to the movie until we've made the movie. Another example is Shawshank Redemption, where they reshot, you know, they went back and shot the scene in which Morgan Freeman appears on the beach and reckons, you know, and sees Tim Robbins. You know, a very inspiring movie, but it ended originally with him on the bus, you know, heading off, and you sort of hoped he got there. Well, it wasn't enough. We had to see that relationship confirmed. So I'm fascinated by this, and I'm talking to a lot of people in Hollywood about it because it's kind of new to everybody to think of it that way.
Have you had a chance to suggest to discuss that with Marty?
I told him, yes, absolutely. I mean, we talked about it. One thing I did say to him was, look, you know, is it true? You know, if Hollywood is sort of proving that relationships matter more than accomplishments, is that borne out by your research? And what he wrote back was, no, women prefer relationships to accomplishments. They'll rate that higher as something that they care about, while men will rate accomplishments. But I think what all this, you know, this is brand new. I gave that speech very recently.
Yeah.
But I feel as though what the movies are telling us is that men may say that they value accomplishments more than relationships, but if they really did, we would end Top Gun with a dogfight.
I think there are two different things going on here, personally. I do think that a component of happiness is, I don't know if accomplishment's the right word, but experiencing one's effectiveness, the experience of, wow, here's something I can do. I can do this well. I mean, you see this all the way up from toddlers, you know, who they want to do it themselves.
Yeah, right, there was right someone away. Else who gave a speech at the Congress who talked about, you know, three other things that people really want, and one of them was competence. You know,
yeah,
autonomy,
competence. Yeah, that's the word I think I was looking for.
Yeah, I think they do want that.
Yeah, the experience of competence, I think, really is an important thing. But that doesn't obviate what you're saying about sharing our successes. I mean, we are social creatures, and we look for that reinforcement that we get from other people who rejoice in our accomplishments and our effectiveness.
I think that's true. And the other thing that I noticed, which was really sort of surprising to me, was that I thought, you know, in most movies that we make, you know, in most general audience movies, and most movies aimed at men specifically, you have the accomplishment and you have the relationship, you know, and the man is trying to accomplish whatever it is he's trying to accomplish. And then there's like a woman who's saying things like, you know, don't race tomorrow, Johnny, I got a bad feeling about it. And you've got a child, you know, maybe saying, don't go, Daddy, you know, stay home with me for once. And you have a father saying, you were never any good, and you're still never any good, and you're never going to accomplish this thing you're trying to accomplish. Now, those are the three classic relationships. And that in many of those movies, not all of them, but most of them, you go through the thing. The person accomplishes what he set out to accomplishment, and then he realizes that what really matters is the relationship, and that's why the movies end that way. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. For women, the accomplishment is the relationship. We don't need a whole movie to teach us what we knew when we walked into the theater. And that's why you have movies like, you know, pretty much every romantic comedy, but movies like Notting Hill and Sleepless in Seattle and you know, so many movies aimed at women, which have nothing to do with accomplishment at all. The accomplishment is, I'm trying to find a guy, and that's it. Or, you know, in some of them, it's a man trying to find a woman. But it's like, you know, it's something like Notting Hill. Hugh Grant works in a bookstore. It's irrelevant. You know, his class is relevant because that's the obstacle of the movie. You know, she's a movie star and he's a bookseller in London. But their class is the obstacle. But their profession, nobody's trying to accomplish. He's not trying to be the best bookseller. You know, and she's not trying to be the best actress. That's not what's going on at all. There is some reference that she wins an Academy Award sort of off-screen somewhere, but it doesn't matter. It's not what the plot is about. The plot is about, are those two people going to get together? And the accomplishment is that they do. And women take, I mean, Hollywood takes so much grief from people saying, you know, that when we make movies like that for women, we're being condescending. You know, making love stories that are nothing but love stories, including the movie Love Story, is condescending. You know, we should be making movies about accomplishments. But actually, this was a huge discovery for me. That, you know, they're saying that women already know. They already know. They don't need the accomplishment. They don't need it to lure them into the theater at all. You know, it's as though you make Top Gun to lure the men into the theater to teach them that the relationship matters more than the accomplishment. But women don't need to be taught that. They know that. So they're perfectly happy to go to see a movie about the accomplishment they care about, which is a relationship.
A relationship.
So this, again, I shared this with some of the female producers that I know, and they're all just kind of stunned by it. It's like all of a sudden they're saying, well, you mean I don't have to be ashamed of this anymore? I don't have to look down on this anymore? I don't have to feel as though I'm making movies which are less than anymore, that I'm making a movie that is just proof that people care about relationships more than anything else, and therefore we're making, you know, it's been very interesting having these conversations. And they're going on literally as recently as this week. I'm engaged with them all the time now because it's really making people think about all of this stuff. So that was some of the stuff I thought about in terms of accomplishments and relationships. But then I wanted to talk about meaning. And I thought it would be interesting to start with Rocky, since we were in Philadelphia for that conference, and we were not very far at all from the museum where Rocky runs up the steps, quite famously, you know, two different times in the movie.
Yes.
And so while I was there, when I got there a day early before the conference, and I actually went to the museum.
Did you run up the steps?
You know, yeah, it was just a little thing. I hadn't really thought about it, but a friend of mine we'd had dinner the night before, and she works at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she was telling me that someone she knew, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, had spent a year at the top of the Rocky Steps interviewing people who were running up them and saying, why is it this movie that's been, I think at that point the movie was 30 years old, what are you doing here? You're not even from America. You're from China, or you're from Japan, or you're from France, or you're from Uruguay. What are you doing here? And what he, and he photographed, and it's a lovely book that he put together. And so much of the time what he found out was that people said, I had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself in the hospital, if I beat this, I'm going to run up those steps, and I'm going to jump up and down like Rocky at the top. Or I had
wonderful.
A heart, I know, or I had a heart transplant, and I said, if this goes well, I'm going to go to Philadelphia, I'm going to fly to Philadelphia, and I'm going to run up those steps, and that's how I'm going to celebrate my victory. And there were people getting married. The day that I went, there were three different weddings going on at the same time. Three different sets of people having their picture taken up at those steps. Not by chance. Not because they think it's a beautiful museum or because they go and see the art there all the time. It's all about Rocky, which is 35 years old.
Amazing.
And, you know, and I thought, well, this really illustrates what Marty is talking about, which is how the arts can carry the message of positive psychology, that how ingrained that is. And when I went there that day, you know, you'll remember it, it was that horrible heat wave.
Yes, that I've
like
forgotten.
Hottest,
but,
yeah, it was like the hottest week on record. And on that particular day, they were expecting a heat index of 115 degrees or something. And if you turned on the radio or turned on the television, they were begging people not to go outside, let alone exert themselves outside. They were literally saying, you can die. If you walk down the street today, you can die. And I took a cab to the museum because I was afraid of walking there. And I walked out onto the steps, and here were all these people running the steps, turning around, pumping their fists in the air, having their picture taken. Children, men, women, Americans, people from other countries. It was all there right in front of me. Three different weddings. And I thought, wow, this is about meaning. And you know, and so I talked about Rocky in the speech, and I talked about how it won the Academy Award for Best Picture and how it was number four on the American Film Institute's list of the most inspirational movies of all time. And that how many movies it spawned. You know, it's like there have been seven sequels so far, or six sequels, something like that, and so many other movies, and about so many other, and even now, as you know, as recently as this week, somebody came in, well, so, you know, it's kind of a Rocky story when they're pitching me something. It's still a very, very strong image in Hollywood about making a movie about an underdog that wins.
Yeah, I just saw The Warrior, and it's definitely a Rocky film.
Yes, it's definitely, absolutely. But what's interesting always about Warriors and about all of these, almost all of these sequels and imitators, is that they don't copy one of the most basic aspects of the Rocky story, which is that Rocky, in the original Rocky, the one that won the Academy Award, the one that's number four on the inspirational list, he didn't win the fight. He didn't win the fight. Nobody remembers this. Even in Hollywood, they don't remember this. I've been annoying people with this information for years now. I'm always in these meetings going, oh, you know, he didn't win. Like, what are you talking about? He didn't win. If you look at the last 5 minutes of Rocky, it's very clear that the fight goes 15 rounds, which is what he said he wanted. All he wanted was to go the distance, he'd said the night before. It goes 15 rounds. He's screaming for Adrian. We don't know how the fight has come out. And then in the background, you see Apollo Creed start jumping up and down in victory. He wins the fight. And what's really important is that a reporter says to him, to Apollo Creed, you want a rematch? And Apollo Creed says, ain't going to be no rematch. Don't want one. In other words, he's too scared.
Yeah.
It's too hard to fight this guy. And that's the victory of the movie. And that's when the music takes off, is at that point, that amazing music cue that happens at the end of the movie starts then. That's the victory. He's, you know, he's gone head-to-head with the world champion and held his own.
Yeah.
And what he's gotten is, what he's won is not the fight. He's won the girl. He's won his own self-respect. He's won the respect of his trainer. He's won all kinds of things that matter more, especially in terms of relationships in his life.
Yeah.
But he didn't win the fight. And then I started looking at that list of inspirational movies and realizing how many of them are about people who don't win. You know, how many of them are about people who don't get what they set out to get. You know, Best Years of Our Lives, the guy sets out to travel the world. He never gets to travel the world. And you know, grapes of wrath. They come to California because they want prosperity, and they find things that are even worse than they were in Oklahoma. If you look at the list, it's quite a long list. It's the top 100 inspirational films of all time. Almost none of them are about people who achieve anything. And then I thought, well, okay, I should look at the box office list, because if I'm looking at the, you know, the biggest box office movies of all time, those will definitely be about winners, right? And I went, well, they are about winners most of the time, but they're usually about winners in the midst of incredible loss. You know, something like Titanic, where 1,500 people on the ship die, or, you know, so many of the really big movies where it's just loss after loss after loss after loss. Schindler's List, and, you know, Harry Potter, where, you know, so many of the mentors die. Gandalf dies, and Obi-Wan dies. And I began to think, well, really what we're saying then is that the accomplishment we're celebrating in these very, very successful movies is resilience. It's the ability to survive loss, which is what, from what I can see, positive psychology really is at its most basic. And that's why in the Army, when they're, you know, teaching all these principles in the Army, they're calling it master resilience training. And I think these movies that we're making, whether it's Schindler's List or Grapes of Wrath or Titanic or any of them, are really master resilience training. That's what we're doing. We're showing how Rocky can survive loss. We're showing how the Jews in, you know, during World War II can survive loss. We're showing how Harry Potter can lose almost everything and survive. And I thought that went right back to positive psychology and definitely has to do with meaning. And what we call in the movie business, we refer to resonance. You know, we'll talk about a movie that resonates.
Mm-hmm.
And the movies that resonate are almost always movies that involve tremendous loss.
That's a fascinating observation. Now, one of the films that I've wanted to ask you about that, mm-hmm. that you worked on is Ferris Bueller's Day
uh-huh.
Off.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the all-time feel-good films. I've
yeah,
seen
I
it
agree.
A number of times, and I always come away with a great feeling. What do you think is the secret? What's the secret sauce there?
Well, I think in some ways Ferris is not quite a human character. If you look at the movie, you see that he does things you couldn't actually do. You know, he runs through people's living rooms and nobody seems to care. He gets up on the parade float and nobody throws him off.
Right.
He seems to be able to go anywhere that he wants to go. He catches a ball. He goes to the ball game and catches a ball. It's like he's a slightly magical character.
Mm-hmm.
He feels a little bit like something out of a Greek myth. He feels a little bit like something out of a fairy tale. And I think he is pure joy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He is a character who simply refuses to not have a wonderful day. You know, he opens the curtains and he sees what a beautiful day is, like, I am not staying in today. And it's about freedom and the joy of freedom and the joy of ignoring the rules.
Yeah, rebellion.
And I think that's
yeah.
a huge, huge part of it. But I think if but then you look at the movie and you say, okay, but it's also, you know, the movie is really about Cameron. We tend to think of, you know, when we're working on, you know, people who work on books or stories or plays or, you know, drama or comedy of any kind, you're always talking about, you know, how does the main character change? Well, Ferris doesn't change. He's exactly the same guy he was at the end of the day that he was at the beginning of the
yeah.
day. It's Cameron who changes. Cameron starts the day terrified of everything and a complete hypochondriac and incapable of experiencing joy. And he ends the day strong and happy and resilient. And it is Ferris who has put him through this, maybe deliberately. It's hinted that Ferris, you know, the girl says, you know exactly what you were doing, you know, when you took off school today at the end. And it's like there's this hint that he always knew what he was doing, that he was going to put Cameron through a terrible experience, hoping to shake him out of this depression and terror that he brings to the world at the beginning of the story. And he does it. He doesn't do it exactly the way he intended to do it. He thought maybe by taking him to the Sears Tower and a baseball game and a stock exchange and a nice restaurant, he could do it that way. Instead, it's by wrecking the car. But he does it. And it's his loyalty to Cameron that gives the movie resonance, I think. That gives it something more than just fun. You know, a movie like The Naked Gun is not resonant. It's
right,
just
right.
fun. You know, Airplane, which is
yeah.
another movie by the same guys,
yeah.
the Duggar Brothers. It's just fun, beginning to end. And that kind of enjoyment it does last. You know, people still talk about Airplane, and it made $100 million. It cost $1 million at the time. And, it, you know, and people still talk about it, and they celebrate its anniversaries. And it's just joy. And I don't think there's anything wrong with pure joy. But I think when you can take the pure joy of a character like Ferris and combine it with the resonance of watching a character like Cameron prepared to stand up to his father for the first time in his life and achieve some kind of peace, I think if anything, that's the reason that the movie has lasted and everybody loves it so much. And yet, as I say, if you look at the movie, there's about 5 minutes in it, if that, that feel anything less than fun.
I have
you know,
to ask
really
you
that
where,
5 minutes.
Yeah, I have to
it.
Ask you where Bollywood fits in here.
I don't know that much about Bollywood. I really don't. I have only seen a couple of those movies.
Well, they're tend to, at least the ones that I've seen are the ones that there have been some Hollywood films that have tried to capture that energy.
Yeah.
They're about romance. That's in there. There's a lot of singing and dancing and joy.
And color and joy.
Yeah,
and it's
color.
Interesting how for, you know, many people in Europe, they find Hollywood movies embarrassing in terms of the amount of fun and happiness that they're willing to put on the screen. And I think even in Hollywood, people find some of the Bollywood movies embarrassing. They find them so shamelessly sentimental.
Yeah.
They find them so bright and fun and upbeat. And it's like it makes you kind of look away, like you're looking away from the sun a little bit. So I think it's like every culture has its own version of how acceptable happiness is and what kind of happiness is acceptable. Because I make a lot of movies in England, and I know that for the English, they find it very, very difficult to accept even the films of, you know, of their own filmmaker, Richard Curtis, who is such a successful filmmaker who wrote Notting Hill and who directed Love Actually, and, you know, he wrote Four Weddings and a Funeral. And he's just tremendously successful at doing these romantic comedies. But in England, they don't like them. You know, the critics hate them.
Amazing.
Yeah, the sophisticated people that I know in England just speak very, very badly about this film. They think they're embarrassing. They think that that kind of sentiment is embarrassing and cynical. They find it very difficult to believe that he is, from his heart, making movies about people who get together and are happy. They think he must be trying to sell out and that he must be trying to make money in Hollywood and things like that. And that's not who he is at all. But they find that very difficult to accept in England. And I think in America we find, you know, that kind of shameless, what we think of as shameless happiness in Bollywood movies, very hard to accept. It isn't our taste.
We're big fans of the Oscars in my family. It's always a big event, a special dinner and so on, watching the Oscars.
Oh,
And I even watched the Emmys this last round. Mm-hmm. And both at the Oscars and particularly in this recent Emmys, there are people who win the award, and when they're up there, they are kind of saying, we had no idea that this movie would be successful. And then there are other movies where huge amounts of money and resources are poured into the movies, and they're flops. After all these years of research and insight, why is it still so difficult to predict what would make audiences happy?
This is a question we ask ourselves every day. We sit in these meetings that go on for hours, working on stories and going, how is it possible that we know so little? And I think the thing is, it's true a little bit for every creative endeavor. I have a friend who's a poet. And she said to me once, you know, every time I write a poem, I have to learn how to write a poem all over again.
Hmm.
And I found that very funny, but very comforting, because it really is true. Every time I make a movie, I have to learn how to make a movie all over again. And it isn't just the physical making of the movie, the actual being on the set and anticipating all of those problems and figuring out how to solve them. But every time I sit down to develop a screenplay, it's as though I've never done it before. It's like I don't know anything. They stick their tongue out at you. You know, they resist you. And I also think that there's something about the simplicity of having a sincere idea and not having enough money to do anything except put that sincere idea on screen that often leans to lots of awards. Rocky is a perfect example of that. You know, they never thought that movie was going to amount to anything other than what some, I think the director said, we thought it would be on the second half of a double bill of a, you know, somebody else's movie. It never occurred to them that that would happen. One of the movies that I worked on that turned out like that was Ghost.
Yeah.
Which was the third movie that year about a ghost. Bill Cosby, I think, had made a movie called Ghost Dad that came out like a month and a half before us. We were sure that that title was going to kill our movie. And then Steven Spielberg, at the height of his success and powers, made a movie called Always with Richard Dreyfuss and Holly Hunter, who were both big stars at that moment, about a romance, you know, where somebody dies and contacts the other person. You know, very, very similar scenes and themes to Ghost. And we were going to be the third one. And, you know, Patrick Swayze was not a big movie star at that point. It wasn't like he was going to guarantee anything. Demi Moore was not a big movie star. It wasn't as though she was going to guarantee anything. Whoopi Goldberg hadn't had a hit movie in years at that point. It was quite controversial actually putting her in the movie. They were afraid she was going to drag it down. Instead, she won the Academy Award. Once they saw the movie, the studio, they loved it. And once they saw it preview and realized that it previewed like nothing they'd ever seen before in terms of audience's response to it, it was like, all right, now how are we going to get people to see it? Because it happens all the time that you make a movie like Warrior, for example, which is a huge crowd pleaser, and nobody comes. They can't figure out how to market it in a way that makes people go. And that's what they were afraid Ghost was going to be. And so they thought, all right, we're going to have to start doing screenings early. You know, we'll preview, you know, we'll have a paid preview, you know, the weekend before it opens, hoping that that will spread the word of mouth. There was no internet. And so they did this, and it's very expensive to open the movie that way. And so they did this paid preview in 1,000 theaters or something the week before the movie opened, and the theaters were packed. Why was that? How did they know? Why was that the right movie at the right time?
Do you have any idea in retrospect now?
Well, you know, I heard that story as a pitch. I mean, literally, the writer came in and said, this is what the movie's about, and I cried in the room. And I had to turn around and pitch it to my boss, and she went, put that into development right away. Huh. And by the time we were ready to show the script to the studio, that woman had left and somebody else was in charge, and he read it and said, oh my God, we have to make this. We were so moved by it. And just that basic concept of, you know, two people who are walking down the street having a conversation and suddenly something happens and one of them is dead is a very frightening thing to everybody. And then the way Finding Nemo is based on the idea of you turn around in the supermarket and your kid's gone. It's a very basic fear that people have. But the bigger fear, the idea that you're the dead person and you can't contact the person that you love and she's sitting right there crying over your body and you can't tell her that you're there, and then you find out she's in trouble and you have to save her. I don't know. I just thought that was one of the best ideas for a movie I'd ever heard. And it's hard to explain Warriors. You know what I mean? I looked at that campaign very carefully. It's hard to say. It's like two brothers are fighting each other, so who am I rooting for? You know, it's like, what is the happy ending in that situation when I like both of them and they're fighting each other? It's just harder. You know, I make it sound easy after the fact, and it never, ever is. But Ghost, I think, was a great idea for a movie and the right movie at the right time. Mm-hmm. People, in spite of the fact that there had been two other movies about Ghost in the last 3 months, that one really spoke to them, and the campaign really showed them how emotionally compelling that situation was. And, you know, it was a lot of different movies. It was very, very funny. It was a thriller. It was a supernatural love story. There's three different movies going on there.
Yeah.
It's very hard to say, though.
Earlier, we were talking about engagement, and I'm wondering, given that you know all the nuts and bolts behind these films, are you still able to be engaged in a movie? Can you enjoy the magic of movies as an audience member?
It's ridiculous how engaged I still am in a movie. I mean, it's embarrassing. I go to see a movie set in outer space and think it was shot in outer space. I completely forget. I really do. It's crazy. I'm completely able to be engaged. If I'm bored, I think I would have been bored anyway, even if I did something else for a living. And at that point, I can sit back and say, oh, I see. You know what the problem is here? You know, I can begin to analyze it as somebody who sort of specializes in script structure. I can sit back and begin to say, you know, I think there's a problem here and they should have done it this way. But if I'm not bored, if I'm engaged in the story, I'm like everybody else in the audience. I'm laughing in all the right places and I'm crying in all the right places and I'm cheering at the end. And,
well,
yeah,
that's fascinating.
Great.
And maybe it's that ability in part that is the gift that you're able to bring to filmmaking.
I think so. I mean, I know that one of the things that I can do that people keep telling me is quite rare is that I can read 30 drafts of a script and still laugh at the same joke. you know, and I really can say, okay, you know, well, these changes all work, but over here, I never mind picking up a script I love the 30th time or the 35th time. It's never a drag. If I'm having a wonderful time, and I see movies over and over and over again, there's nothing I like more than turning on the television and saying, oh, I love this movie. Let's watch it again. You know, and that can be movies that I've seen literally, 100 times. I worked as an usherette. It was one of my very first jobs as a human being, was as an usherette at a theater in Los Angeles. And I would literally watch a movie twice in my job as usherette, and then when I take off my uniform, put on my regular clothes, sit down in the theater and watch it again. Because I just love them that much. And, you know, sometimes as a filmmaker, you see, as a studio executive especially, you see 5 movies a day. It's not uncommon. It's definitely not uncommon to see 2 or 3 movies a day. Nobody even thinks about that.
Wow.
How strange that is from the outside.
Yeah.
How weird that is. But for us, it's not strange at all, and consequently, we're in the right business. Now, there are definitely people in the movie business who don't enjoy movies, including filmmakers. You know, Woody Allen talked about never watching his movies. It was just too painful. And Sidney Pollack, who I worked for 8 years, it was way too hard for him to watch the movies that he made.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't enjoy the experience at all. He didn't enjoy sitting with an audience and watching it, and he didn't enjoy sitting alone and watching it. He just didn't enjoy it, and yet that's what he did for a living. So figure that out.
But you are able to enjoy the movies that you've worked on, and
completely. And some people find that to be quite, you know, not maybe what you should do. I mean, for example, when I showed *Sense and Sensibility* at the master's class at Penn in April, I hadn't seen it for years, and I said to them, you know, it's sad because I made this movie because I love the book, and I love the movie. And I would be too embarrassed to watch it at all. It would feel too stupid. What if somebody came in and said, what are you doing? You're watching your own movie? And, you know, I have to be careful by saying my own movie. Obviously, it's, you know, the director and the actors and the writer and everybody. But you know, it's a movie. I love that book, and I always wanted to make it into a movie. And I've spent years looking for a writer, and I found Emma Thompson, who'd never written a screenplay in her life, and I had this hunch that she could do it. And then she won the Oscar for Best Screenplay. And, you know, so the whole thing was such a success story on so many levels. But mostly, I love the movie. Mostly, the movie is exactly the way I wanted the movie to be when I thought about making a movie out of it when I was 22 years old. So, and that was many, many years before the movie was actually made. So I am completely capable of watching Sense and Sensibility, laughing at all the jokes, and crying at the end. I have no problem with that whatsoever. And, you know, not everybody can do that. Scott Rudin, who's a very, very successful film producer and theater producer, you know, probably one of the most successful of all time. He and Brian Grazer, who's another extremely successful film producer, Ron Howard's producing partner, were producing a movie together quite a long time ago, and they were both on a dais together being interviewed, and some reporter said, you know, what drives you? And almost at the same time, they said the same thing, which was fear of failure. And I thought, God, that's never driven me for a second in my whole life. You know, it just isn't. And I went to Jerry Zucker, you know, who directed, you know, who was one of the directors of Airplane and the producer, one of the writers of Naked Gun, and who I had hired to direct Ghost. And I said to him, what drives you? And he said, gosh, it's that moment in the theater where everybody's laughing at the same time or gasping at the same time. I said, yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly what drives me, is sitting in a theater surrounded by paying customers and having them have the enjoyable experience that you hope they would have. And most of the people that I work with, that is their answer to that question. But there are plenty of other people who are doing it out of some kind of drive from a negative place, and they're the ones who don't sit through their movies.
Yeah.
You know, and who have a hard time with it.
Yeah, Lindsay, it would be so easy to just go on and on with you. There are lots of other questions I could ask, but try to keep this within some reasonable kind of range, particularly for a person who is as busy as you are. So I really want to thank you. This has been delightful.
You're so welcome. It's, you know, I realize I suddenly went, oh gosh, I've been talking too much.
No, not at all.
Inch-wise.
So, Lindsay Doran, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome.
As I believe I mentioned in the interview, Lindsay and I met in a small group that was a breakout of a presentation that was being conducted by Nick Marks from the UK, who is a superstar in his own right and with whom I conducted a brief interview that I played a couple of podcasts ago. Nick is definitely worthy of a much longer interview for his amazing work promoting positive psychological health through a program called The Five Ways, which he's been executing throughout Britain. So Lindsay and I were in a small group for a brief exercise, and my initial impression was that she was quiet and maybe introverted and did not particularly stand out, except that I had heard Marty Seligman mention her name in his initial keynote, so I had mentally tagged her as someone to interview. Then later, I happened to attend her presentation, and she was a fireball and a real audience favorite. So once again, Dr. Dave has his nose rubbed in the lesson of the error of snap judgments and first impressions. I think in the interview you just heard, you could get a sense of her vibrancy and quick, crackling intelligence. As you also heard, she chalked up a lot of the success of her talk to the fact that she did not lean on a PowerPoint. Another great reminder to all those of us who tend to do that. I recall another wonderful presentation I attended some years ago in which the woman used old technology, namely an overhead transparency projector and a grease pen. She engaged the audience with great intensity, scribbling and improvising key points and diagrams as she went along, dialoguing with members of the audience, holding eye contact, and never turning her back to write on a whiteboard or chalkboard or look at a PowerPoint. So listen up, all you students and public presenters. And while I have this podium, I need to mention that I was very saddened by the passing of Steve Jobs earlier this week. I've been a huge fan of Apple Computer ever since its very early days. I had an Apple II, and then most of the subsequent Macintosh models that came along over the years. I haven't kept count, but I wouldn't be surprised if I'm on my 15th Apple Computer. And I've had 3 or 4 iPhones and 2 iPads and a MacBook Air. Not all at once, mind you. I was privileged to be in the same room with Steve Jobs years back when a business partner and I were facilitating an ideation and planning session with the Mac team on the Apple campus in Cupertino. A young, long-haired and bearded Steve Jobs came in about halfway through the session and made some pronouncements, and then left. I didn't have a chance to engage with him personally, and that's probably just as well, because he was known to be especially mercurial and fierce in those days. Still, I think he stands out as the greatest business leader of maybe the last 100 years. For better or worse, he's transformed the entire planet in ways that are both obvious and some that are yet to be discovered. I'm very saddened by his passing, but happy to have lived in his time and to have been a witness and beneficiary of his vision and drive.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. And Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
Hey, there's a new badge in the right-hand sidebar on the shrinkwrapradio.com website. It's an amazon.com widget. It's got a field right in the widget in which you can type in what you're looking for, and it's got a drop-down menu for the various categories, or you can just click on the black area at the bottom of the widget, and it will take you right to the Amazon site on your browser. Now, the great thing is, this is a way you can help support the show, not only by buying the books you learn about here, but by using it for any and all of your Amazon purchases. In fact, if you'll click on that black area and then bookmark the Amazon page that comes up and put that bookmark on your desktop somewhere where it's easy to access for all of your Amazon shopping, that would be a great idea because it will have our ID code in the URL, and then we'll get a small percentage of all your purchases. I'll bet a bunch of you have your eye on that new Kindle Fire model that was announced for $199, and you'll probably be buying one for yourself or as a Christmas present for someone in your family. I know I regularly buy a certain breakfast cereal and a Kona blend coffee that we can't find in our local stores. I know a lot of you probably don't go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website to listen to these shows. You're listening on an MP3 player or phone or whatever, and soon I hope you'll be listening on our upcoming iPhone or Android app. But you probably do buy things from Amazon from time to time, and if you'll create a bookmark with the URL that has our code, you'll be making regular, painless contributions. It's really a win-win. And while you're looking at the right-hand sidebar, notice the new widget for our CE unit courses at the Zur Institute. Right now, there are 4 courses you can take just for listening to Shrink Wrap Radio episodes. Who knew education could be so much fun, right? And since this show is running long, I won't even mention that you should click on the big green donate button or that we're still waiting for our first super colossal donor who will get their business name mentioned on every episode for a year. No, I won't even breathe a word about that.
Hi, I'm Oscar, undergrad student at Stockholm University, Sweden. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave. He's got his mindset on your mindset.
Indeed I do, Oscar. Let's squeeze in some emails. First, we hear from Michelle, Oscar's friend at the University of Stockholm, as it happens, who writes in reply to my thanking her for clicking on that big green donate button. Michelle writes, David, you're very welcome. This is something I can afford, and I really want to contribute to your continuing effort to make your podcasts. There are so many things that are beneficial for us listeners. I've learned a lot, not just about the different topics that have been brought up in the shows. You're a very good role model when it comes to interviewing. And the top thing is something more on a meta level. Every show is proof of you being a person curious about and interested in life, as in psychology, technology, music, etc. And it seems like you have had these traits all your life, like your friend Jerry. Yes to all of the above. She goes on to say, I've always started up different projects since childhood and always been driven by wanting to know more. Good for you. At times that has been difficult. I once had an ex-boyfriend who told me that I should stop trying to think about my crazy ideas. I told him that my mantra was, why not, and that I would never give in to believing that I had to restrain my thoughts. By that, I do not mean that all ideas that I have are good ones, like the wish to become an astronaut, something that is virtually impossible. But a friend of mine told me recently to watch a TV program about scientists that are going for space flights with commercial companies. I think they will be brought in pods to the upper level of the atmosphere, and then the pods will be released and drawn back to Earth. This will allow the scientists to do some experiments while they're in free-falling mode. The window of opportunity has been opened due to economic crisis that has led to the shutting down of the space shuttle program at NASA. So maybe I will be going to Mars after all. Oh, and one more thing. I haven't been able to get this out of my mind. I remember that you told us listeners that your stepfather is of African-American heritage. Did I get that right? In my teens, I was dancing electric boogie, hip-hop, and jazz dance on the streets of Stockholm. Many of my friends had different ethnic backgrounds, and many of them were blacks. I am, as you know, of Japanese and Finnish descent, but my friends used to say that I was one of them. I seriously thought of myself as a black person for many years, and since I've conducted gospel choirs, we were only singing black gospel music, This diverse culture has had a great impact on me. I was curious about what kind of impact your family constellation had on you. Please feel free to answer if you want to. No pressure here. Just want to get it out of my system. Well, time for me to continue what I was doing before writing this email. Have a nice weekend and take care. Bestest regards, Michelle. Well, Michelle, okay, I will try to address that question succinctly because, you know, there's so much that I could say on that topic. So what I will say is, yes, I was raised by a African-American stepfather. He's since passed on. But that experience, both of growing up with him and much of the time in a black neighborhood, had a profound impact on my musical self, among others. And that's why I'm so drawn to blues, to roots-type blues, country folk blues from the rural South. It just resonates with me so deeply. And I tried to learn to play it on the guitar and can do a sort of half-baked version sometimes, or used to be able to. I'm not nearly as realized with my music as I would like to be. And how wonderful that you've led a black gospel music choir. Wow. I've often thought, you know, I've grown away from the church, but if I were to go back to the church, I'd want to go to a black church. I grew up part-time in an African-American Episcopal church where they had a wonderful, wonderful choir, wonderful preacher, just like the ones you hear and see in the good movies about that culture. So thanks for asking about my background, and maybe I'll let other little leaks out as time goes by. Next, we hear from Tony, who posted the following comment in response to episode number 279 on Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World with Francis Weller. And Tony writes, "Dear Dave, I love this interview, and it was just what I needed to hear this morning as I prepared to go to work. In a parallel process, I had also been listening to a lot of positive psychology-type material recently, and this provided a counterbalance to that, quotes, light approach, as you say, for myself. I could see how I'm usually unconsciously at the effect of this denial of grief in our culture, with how I relate to my own grief, but also how the world we live in is a manifestation of this denial, with all its troubles, its lack of connection, lack of communal ritual, and lack of connection between our action and their effects on the soul of the world. I breathed a bit easier knowing that my relation to my own grief was as much a cultural pattern as my own stuff. Thanks again, Tony." Tony, thanks so much for writing that, and to all the other people who made comments about the interview with Francis Weller. So many people were moved by the depth of his being as it came across in the interview, as was I. And as one listener suggested, I should find excuses or ways in my life to spend more time with him. And I think that's a great suggestion. So that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments like Tony did about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave voicemail on our phone in the U.S. Just dial 001 if you're outside it, and 206-337-0622. Thanks so much to my guest, Lindsay Duran, for sharing her insider's perspective on what makes for happy movies. My next guest will be noted transpersonal psychologist, Dr. James Fadiman, and we'll be discussing his new book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. It's bound to be a fascinating topic. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.